I'm Lindsay Claiborne.
And I'm Mumu Shu, and you are listening to Beyond the Microscope.
Hi, everyone. It is Lindsay and Mumu back for another episode of Beyond the Microscope. Today, our guest is Jackie Stenson, who is a co-founder of S-Mart, a social enterprise bringing life-improving technologies to rural communities. Thanks for being on our show, Jackie.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Let's start with the first question. What is S-Mart?
So S-Mart is a socially focused company that works in like peri-urban and rural communities, starting in India. And we have a catalog of life-improving technologies, things like solar lanterns and water filters and clean cook stoves. And we connect these products to mom-and-pop shops so that people who live in villages can access these products when they're buying their everyday goods.
What kinds of technologies? You mentioned sort of solar lanterns, all these things. So what types of technologies are available?
So right now, if you live in a small village in a developing country around the world, you do most of your shopping at like mom and pop shops where you'll find things like Coca-Cola and shampoo, soaps and things like that. But for the most part, that's pretty much all that's available. These like fast moving consumer goods or FMCG products. There's tons of people around the world that are trying to design products that can both improve the lives and the livelihoods of people that live in low-income, low-resource settings. Things like solar lights and water filters, clean cook stoves, efficient agricultural tools, a lot of mechanical engineering solutions. But the biggest challenge that all of these products face is distribution. When you actually go to villages, like no one has any idea that these products exist or how to get them. So those channels, they exist for Coca-Cola and shampoo and soaps, but they don't exist for durable, innovative, life-improving technologies. So those are the types of products that we're trying to actually get out there and make accessible for people.
How did you find this hole in the food, in the delivery chain? I mean, how did you come up with this as an idea?
Yeah, so I started as a mechanical engineer with Mumu.
Yay!
In undergrad, which feels like a long time ago now, and was like really interested in designing a lot of these products as an engineer. And so I got a postgraduate traveling fellowship, which basically means that a whole bunch of people thought it was a really good idea to give me a lump sum of money to essentially do whatever I wanted. And my proposal was to start in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, and hitchhike my way to South Africa while working with different technology for development initiatives. So water pumps in Ethiopia, plastics recycling in Kenya, bicycle-powered machines in Tanzania. And for me, it was over the course of what was supposed to be a one-year fellowship, but I stretched it to over the course of about 2 years that I realized that a lot of the products that I wanted to design already existed. And not only had they already existed, but they had existed for a really long time. I was in Malawi and I found this book written by UNICEF called Appropriate Technology, a Roundtable Discussion. And I'm flipping through it and seeing the design of the peanut sheller and the rope and washer water pump and all of these technologies that I was working with. But the date on the book was April 22nd, 1983. And so we've been working on these products for a really long time. And yet when you actually go to villages, no one has any idea that these products exist. So at the end of my two-year journey, I realized that the supply chain gap was what I was really passionate about, and I did something I never thought I would do. I went to grad school, and I did a master's in a course called Engineering for Sustainable Development, where I actually focused on sustainable development from the perspective of like international development and sustainable from the perspective of people actually use your stuff after you've developed it. And so I studied dissemination channels for these types of products for about a year.
Are people surprised like you were with the hole in the supply chain, or was it sort of like everybody's like, oh yeah, we sort of know about that, but that's not as fun? Is there a difference?
Yeah. There, you know, you see sort of both sides of the spectrum. You see definitely people that are well aware of the problem, and these are typically people that have like spent a lot of time. And sort of the general mantra is that if you work in international development or if you work in emerging markets, you know that distribution is probably the biggest unsolved problem for actually creating impact with life-improving technologies. So I think it's becoming more accepted within that sector, although when we started this a bunch of years ago, there's virtually no one focusing on distribution because it's not sexy, it's not interesting, like people don't want to fund it. So there's definitely sort of a gap between, even within the sector. And outside of the sector, it's actually really surprising how many people don't realize how much of a problem that this is, especially in different markets around the world where you can order anything or buy anything at your local shop. That's just not the case for about half the world's population. When we deliver products, we literally take products, we put them on motorbikes, and we drive them out to village shops. But I've definitely been asked before, like, oh, do you deliver products via drones? And I'm like, no, in rural India, that does not work. Like, that's not necessary. That's not what's necessary.
I'm only one person.
I know, but you're drones.
Maybe.
You can work on integrating drones into our delivery model, although it might be beyond like the cost bandwidth of many of our
customers. A little bit, yeah.
Yeah, but there's definitely been a lot of resistance when we were first starting off in terms of like, why is this a problem? I'm more interested in the technology. I'm more interested in designing a sort of like a sexy gadget or like a little widget or something like that. And a lot of what I had to do coming from the engineering perspective is say like, you know, products are great, but we actually have to get them to people in order to make sure that they're achieving impact. So that's definitely a challenge that we had to overcome / still overcome on a daily basis, especially with funders.
So how did you get started, or how did you meet Diana, and then how did you two get started with this?
Yeah, so when I finished my master's, I actually had a full-time job lined up, and I moved back to the U.S. and was ready to get started, and my full-time job offer was rescinded because there was some internal difficulties in the company. And so I basically moved back to the States. I found myself jobless. I had no idea really what I wanted to do. And I started trying to figure out what would be the best path to take. So I had spent a lot of time at MIT in undergrad. There's a course there called D-Lab that focuses on designing technologies for developing countries and emerging markets and co-creating these products with communities. And so I went and I visited some of my old professors at D-Lab and was chatting to one of them. And he was kind of like, well, what do you want to do? And I was like, I don't know, I'll do anything. And he was like, no, what do you really want to do? And so I basically said that I wanted to create a technology agnostic dissemination channel that will help life improving products actually reach people and be adopted by people. And his response was, great, I have a co-founder for you. And he introduced me to Diana, who turns out had been on quite a similar parallel path as I had been. Whereas I was in Africa, she was in India most of the time, and we wrote our master's dissertations on like almost identical topics before we knew each other, and so I think just luck of the draw.
That's very serendipitous.
Yeah, definitely.
Not to mention
people
that
always ask me how to find a co-founder, and
yeah,
I have no idea
like,
how.
I don't know, and the fact that you actually work well together is the other bonus factor, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think like the thing about having a co-founder, as I'm sure you guys know, it's kind of like being married. So I consider Diana like my second spouse. And so we are very different people, but we complement each other's work styles really well. And she's someone that I like 100% trust. And that is, I mean, trust is sort of the foundation for getting things done, knowing how people work, et cetera. And so, we've definitely like worked together really well as worked, like helped each other work on our sort of co-leading styles really well.
And how did you guys decide to focus on India?
So we chose India for a couple reasons. Our premise for how to get technologies to be adopted, and specifically like innovative technologies, is that you want someone who you already trust to help explain the product to you. So the best way that we think to get these products to people is to put them into places where they already shop with someone that they already have a trusted buying relationship with. So in India, the mom and pop shop network is about 15 million strong. It's the second biggest employer after agriculture, accounts for 10% of the country's GDP, and of the $550 billion that happen in retail in India, the mom and pop shops account for 500, so 90%. So in terms of like actual people that we can work with to help get these products out to people, India made a ton of sense. From a technology perspective as well, India was a great choice. So there's hundreds of people out there that are trying to design sort of hardware, durable goods that can improve lives beyond the major cities. And in India, there's a ton of local innovations, whether it's coming out of the local universities and the incubators. There's also just a ton of inventors. There's a huge culture of engineering and design and entrepreneurship. And so we're essentially an aggregator of technologies. We can source all of our products within India's borders without needing to import. And we can work with local innovators who can design for and with the communities. It's also really great for us to be able to give feedback to our suppliers. So we can tell them, you know, like this feature is not good, this brightness needs to be higher. And we can really work closely with a lot of our suppliers to improve the technologies themselves. So India made sense from sort of like both sides of the supply chain.
And in terms of the technologies, so, you know, you had mentioned that there are a lot of technologies and inventions that were out there, they just weren't getting to people who needed it. So how do you choose which ones you are going to supply?
Yeah, that's a great question, because there's a lot of products that are out there. So first, we work with products that are focused on improving people's lives in some way, shape, or form. So that's actually fairly broad. So we have everything from solar lanterns and clean cook stoves, which are sort of typical products that you would think of in this sector, to high quality motorbike helmets and flashlights that are rechargeable or significantly more durable than the cheap options on the market. The first thing is that we want to make sure that what we're choosing is actually going to help people and is essentially filling an essential need. A lot of the choice comes from sort of our team and just of our founding team. About half of us are engineers, and a bunch of the other ones went to MIT, even though they didn't actually study engineering. So we have a really strong sort of technical skill set. But frankly, a lot of our product choice comes from the customers ourselves. So we work with the mom and pop shops, and they provide tons of recommendations to us on what they want to see in the products, what the features they want to see in the products, especially in rural India, and especially in the south, where there's a fair number of local engineering colleges. People are really technically inclined. So we don't get requests that say like brighter. We get requests that are like, I want to be able to have a beam that focuses for 20 meters. You know, like we get like specific technical requests, and we're like, we'll try to do that. Cause then they also probably want that for a price of like $3, which sometimes is a really difficult. So
the business side of it, there's sort of obvious things like we need to get a product to our customers and we need to sell it. But to understand supply and demand and pricing and how you know whether something that's, you know, the equivalent of $3 versus the equivalent of $30 is something worthwhile. I mean, how did you even sort of begin to get your feet wet in that?
Yeah, you're right. Like it's sort of a business skill set that I definitely did not have when I was starting. I think this might sound terrible, but it's so much harder to get the engineering skill set than it is to get the business skill set. Like having a background in engineering was the perfect starting point, because you can learn a lot of that stuff on the job or through research or through teaching yourself. And so actually these like past couple of years for me have been an interesting lesson in business, while also sort of being able to use a lot of my foundational technical language to make sure that like I actually understand the products that we're working with, because when it comes down to it, explaining the products to customers and getting people excited about products is like, that's what we're in the business of. We're in the business of helping new innovations reach rural areas and people that can benefit from them. But I've had to learn a lot of the business skill set. Some of it's been fun. Like I like thinking about supply chains and data management. Some of it, like finance, is not my favorite thing. It's sort of like a necessary evil. We have a great CFO, like one of our co-founders who's our CFO is fantastic and basically just gave me like a brain dump of how to do income statements and balance sheets and cash flows in like about an hour. And I was like, great, I got it, enough. So, and then we moved on.
All right, so I want to back up a little bit and talk about how you sort of founded this. So, okay, so now you and Diana have met and said, great, we think alike and completely differently, and it works. And now what? Now what?
Think alike completely differently. I like that. Yeah. It's a good catchphrase.
Yeah, we think alike. We should start using that as like our tagline, like Jackie and Diana, we think alike and completely differently. Something like that.
Like
and then
it.
We can play the song Jack and Diane, our theme song.
There you go.
Okay, so I'm sort of curious, like, at that point, what's your next step? Like, what do you do?
Yeah, so I guess there were two things. As soon as we came together, there were sort of two things that went through our mind. One, does our idea work? Two, how do we get money to try it? So sort of, luckily, we were in the MIT ecosystem, and we got a bunch of grants. And by a bunch, I mean like two, but a couple grants. And that was what enabled us to run a pilot. And our first pilot was basically testing the foundational theory of sort of our model, which was if we put life-improving durable goods into local mom-and-pop shops, would they sell? So that was our initial pilot. So we bought a whole bunch of products, and by a whole bunch, I mean 12, and we stuck them into two shops in like rural South India. The first person that I called up was Prashant, one of my classmates from my master's, who's actually from South India, mechanical engineering background and works in sales and marketing. So he was like the perfect fit to work with us and has been working with us since. And so we went down to South India, we put products in shops and we were like, can you sell these? And they all sold out within a week. And so we were like, okay, great. Like that works. So, and then it was really a matter of trying to find additional funding to get started. Cause one of the challenges with distribution is it's really a scale business. Like you have to do it at scale in order to make it profitable, to take advantage of some of the buying power, to get the right margins. And so we were fortunate in that we won a big competition in the spring of 2013 that gave us some of our initial funding, and it was about 50K, and then we won another 10K from MIT, and we were like, great, we have money in the bank, let's actually incorporate something and get started. But it was a complete learning process because, you know, I never thought I would be an entrepreneur, definitely, like, or even a business person. I was going to build products for the rest of my life, and then I realized that, like, the product design is really important, but I also want to help make sure that the products that I'm designing are helping the markets that I'm designing them for, which in my case was like rural areas and in emerging markets and developing countries. So,
Jackie, when you're looking at these products that you're selling, are there times when you're like, oh, that's such a great idea, or you know what I would do to that? If I could change it, do you sort of feel that pull back to the actual development of the tech, or are you so sort of busy with the other stuff that it doesn't pop up?
So that's actually a really timely question, because I feel like in the past year, I've definitely started to feel that pull back to the actual tech. I think maybe just this is my personality, but I definitely tend to be like a pendulum swinging from like one extreme to the other. So, you know, at first I was like, I'm just going to design tech and more tech and it's going to be great and I love building stuff. And then I was like, tech is worthless without distribution. Distribution is everything. And then I sort of have swung back to the middle in that the distribution is incredibly important, but it's not a replacement for shoddy product design. And I think that the more that we sort of look for good products in our catalog, the more we realize how many prototypes there are, but how many few commercialized products there are. And so sometimes it's really simple things like packaging and branding. Sometimes it's more complicated things like making sure that your finishing and your moldings are actually of a good quality so that it looks like it's an actually like a professionally made product. And there's also the more that we do distribution, the more that we've actually sort of identified gaps in the market for where there aren't actually products, like there aren't making a specific product that fits someone's specific need that we've gotten requests for this product from, you know, 100 shops in our network. And so figuring out the best way to sort of feed this information back to the suppliers, whether or not sort of like I can get my hands dirty again, which is always fun, is sort of, I think, our next step. We've started doing market testing for suppliers, so actually like taking late stage prototypes and products that have been developed in other markets and actually putting them into shops in our network and watching how they sell under different constraints. So what if we price them at different price points, or what if we package them in different packagings, or what if we offer different features like in different shops? Are they going to sell a different amount, or which one's going to be the most effective based on like actual customer feedback and sales data? And then we can get that back to the suppliers and have them refine their product so that it's better suited to customers' needs. I think like the goal for S-Mart was always to be this essential marketplace. S-Mart. It works kind of. So it was to be this essential like marketplace where you can basically create like this, be the single point of contact through which the shops and the end customers can actually get their voices heard by the suppliers and vice versa, so that we can actually have just like better design products all around.
What's a typical day like for you?
I wish I had a typical day. I wish I even had a typical time that I woke up or time that I went to sleep, but I don't think either of those things are true.
We should really say that we are talking to you while you are in India.
Yes.
So just to give some context, that it is 7 in the morning for me. It is 10 in the morning for Mumu. And what time is it for you?
It is 9:15 p.m. on a Friday night. So I'm super cool hanging out inside.
That sounds about like the rest of us.
And so like today, for example, I basically sat around my computer and did a combination of like emails and graphic design work and met with a couple people. I actually had a meeting at 6 a.m. this morning, so that was fun. And then had a couple other meetings throughout the day. But actually earlier this week, I was in my car driving around villages, meeting up with mom and pop shops, looking at the products that they're selling, talking to our sales team and refining our list of products, getting feedback on all of the products in our catalog, looking for new suppliers, et cetera. So I'd say that it sort of varies from these extremes. I'm either like behind my computer answering a bunch of emails and coordinating times when I can meet up with people in person, or I'm like behind the wheel of my car driving for 10 hours and visiting our customers.
So I want to ask, what's been the most difficult or surprising challenge so far? Maybe those two things are different.
But. Yeah. Difficult, most surprising challenge. Definitely one of the most difficult challenges is the funding perspective. Distribution is one of those things that's probably the most under-recognized, underfunded problem in international development. Because it's this messy supply chain problem, because it's not a silver bullet solution, because you can't explain it with one picture, like that makes it really challenging to fund. It also, most funders sort of have these vertical categorical mandates, like I want to fund water or energy or sort of property rights, and distribution sort of is a cross-cutting like horizontal bucket and doesn't necessarily fit. And so it does make funding extremely difficult, especially because we definitely see funding trends moving more and more towards mobile apps, which are great, but unless you have the physical movement of goods, your mobile app in this space is not going to be particularly effective. Most surprising was actually probably that I thought that there would be more better products than they are. So it gets me excited to see how we can facilitate the whole product development pipeline and make sure that products just aren't getting stuck in the prototype phase and are actually getting out of universities and out of labs and out of innovation centers and actually getting into the hands of people. I've always known that there's a ton of great prototypes, but actually commercializing products and getting them to the point that a company like S-Mart, like a company like mine, can actually distribute them, that's a whole other ballgame. And so that, I think, was surprising for me. Like, I thought that there would be more tech available than there is. So it really is sort of, we do need to work on both sides, both the distribution and both the technology development and better commercialization.
When doing what you're doing, a lot of people probably interpret it as like, oh, you're doing nonprofit work, you're doing aid work. Talk a little bit about your decision in terms of, you are a for-profit, technically, company. What does that mean, and how does that affect what you do?
Yeah, in a lot of developing countries around the world, historically, distribution has been left to nonprofit and aid organizations. And what that usually looks like is a nonprofit shows up, in a particular community, tells the community what they think their problems are, finds a product for the community, like this water filter that we think will help you, and then dumps the product on the community. And typically what happens is the community will say, yes, 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 this product will be great, because no one wants to turn down free products. You know, I collect free stuff from every conference I go to, even though I don't actually need it, just because it's free, you know? And so the community will get the products. They might not know how to use them. They certainly don't know how to fix them when they break, or if they do know how to fix them, they don't have access to the spare parts. And inevitably, these products end up becoming trash. They're not actually used. And so I think that a lot of that problem stems from the fact that a lot of these sort of charity-based initiatives treat their customers as like passive recipients of aid, because the people that are actually funding them tend to be donors who are sitting in a fancy office very far away, very disconnected from the real issues. So a big part of starting S-Mart is that we wanted to make sure that our customers were actually having a direct say in what products are or are not in our catalog, and that they're treated like active customers and active decision makers in their own life, that they have a choice to choose what technology they want to adopt, that they can choose which model works for them versus just being given one particular model. And so something that I believe wholeheartedly in is that development is more sustainable when you treat people as active customers and decision makers rather than passive recipients of aid. So S-Mart, we have a social mission. We care a lot about the socially impactful products that are in our catalog. But more than anything, we are a marketplace. And if you ask any of our customers, like, they'll tell you that we are a company and that we're there to serve their needs with products that are essential for their everyday activities. And that's what we're going for. And that's why we chose the legal structure that we did, in part.
And it's logistically easier, right? I mean,
it's definitely logistically easier. India requires a lot of paperwork to do lots of things.
I feel like you're censoring yourself a little bit there.
That was a little bit of an understatement. It took us 6 months to open our bank account when we first started.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
We're now trying to open a second bank account. We have been for the last 3 months.
I see. So we'll you've got happens. 3 more months to go at least, right?
3 more months to go, yeah, if we're on track. but so India is like, it's huge. It's got the population of sub-Saharan Africa. It's got states that might as well sort of be their own countries because they have their own language. They have their own culture. They have their own food. And so we buy products from other states in India, and then we have to move products across state borders. So being incorporated as a for-profit actually makes a lot of that easier. So we have certain, essentially, S-Mart's business model is that we buy products in bulk from suppliers, and then we wholesale them to mom and pop shops. So we're a registered wholesaler. And doing that with a nonprofit is quite difficult. We need certain forms that can give us tax breaks when we move products across borders, like all of that stuff. And so as a for-profit company, that just sort of makes life a lot easier. There's a lot of, it would be a lot more challenging, I think, if we were a nonprofit status and then basically participating in wholesale activities. So
what do you see as, what's your long-term vision?
If I can work on S-Mart and basically create a single point of contact through which durable, innovative, life-improving products can reach end customers for the rest of my life, not only within India, but in other countries around the world, that is what I will do. You know, I would love to just continue building it up, continue growing S-Mart, expanding throughout India, expanding throughout other emerging markets where there's huge mom and pop retail shop networks and a lot of customers in need of good quality products. We want to be this transparent marketplace that actually distributes the products, but also provides a flow of information from the customers back to the suppliers so we can actually design better products. I think that there's so much potential around data, around what end customers wants, around actually refining what products we're offering to people and making them better based on customer needs. Like there's a lot of stuff going on that I think is really important, but it'll take time to build out. And if it means that I'm doing this for the next like 20, 30 years, then like, cool, sounds good.
But it seems like you guys have, you just were mentioning data. You have the what people don't know yet, which is what stuff actually is helpful and used and what people actually want. Not like, hey, this lantern will provide you energy for this and this and this. That sounds great. And people are like, yeah, that's nice, but that's not really what I need right now.
Right, yeah. No, I can tell you what people want based on what they actually buy. And, like, I can tell you which model of lantern people prefer in the regions that we work in. We're not big enough yet for me to, like, publish some sort of really powerful report, but, like, I want to be. I want to be able to come and be like, 8 organizations, you're distributing the wrong stuff because no one wants this. That's not what they buy when given the choice. And that's the thing. It's like most rural customers, they don't have access to a choice of products. They usually only have one product that is dumped on them. And being able to figure out what they actually want, which features they prefer, what price points they're willing to pay, I feel like our perceptions around price points for technology is way off. We think that like cheaper and lower quality is better, but that's not actually true. People want they want more bang for their buck. They want something that is aspirational, is high quality, that will have multiple features. Like the more expensive stuff, to a certain extent, sometimes sells better than the cheaper editions of the models. And this is, I think, yeah, there's a ton of potential for being like, this is what people want. This is where the gaps are. This is what new technologies need to be made. These are the technical specification requirements of these new technologies so that you can actually have like real design constraints. Like there's a ton of potential for facilitating the whole supply chain, but we need to be bigger. So we must keep trudging forward.
Well, Jackie, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. This has been fascinating.
Like our show? Find out more at scopepodcast.com and follow us online on Facebook and Twitter at Scope Podcast. This is Lindsay Claiborne
and Mumu Shu.
Our theme music was composed by The Copycuts. Thanks for listening.